Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by New York Wines, reminding you to eat and drink local this Thanksgiving. For more information, visit newyorkwines.org.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Queeg.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show aims to bring culture to horticulture.
Yeah.
And that's what we're going to do today.
And I realized I just sounded like Bugs Bunny when I said my last name.
Yeah. Marcus Queeg.
No, I sounded like Elmer Fudd.
That's all right. We have an Elmer Fudd in the office, in the Oval Office right now, coming into the Oval Office. So our last show was the day before Election Day. How hopeful were we that day? We were so hopeful. So much has changed in the past week by the election of a president that is both detested and feared by so many people, and yet who was elected by just under 50% of voters.
25% of voters, yeah. To be exact.
Yeah. So where are we a week later? For those such as myself who were saddened and angered by Donald Trump's election, we kind of needed some time to process it. It really was a surprise.
Absolutely.
For a lot of people.
I think for him, too, frankly.
Yeah, I think it was.
He looked like a deer in headlights that night.
Yeah. So for me, I'm going to share the story. For me, it was so shockingly unexpected that coincidentally, late into the night. Just as it was beginning to sink in that he would probably win, I tripped and fell down a flight of stairs, okay? I didn't get seriously hurt, but I have a large, ugly bruise to remind me of Election Day for a while.
Bruise is going to stay for a while.
It is.
Time.
I like to call it my Trump sign.
Is it orange colored?
No. It's going to get there, though. It's purple now. I can't show it in polite company. Anyway, so my injury is going to take some time to heal, and I think we're going to take some time to heal as a nation. So like so many others, we're moved to act, to do something positive, to counterbalance some of the dread and powerlessness that we feel. So today's show is part two of the series we started last week called Politics and Place. It's a series that Alice and I planned long before the election to discuss the importance of civic involvement in our green spaces. And of course, it's more important now than ever. We have elected a president that said he believes climate change is a Chinese hoax. For those of us working daily to green and preserve public and private open space, that is unfathomable. We the people have to continue to refute those retrograde and destructive ideas, and we can do that with education and action. So we have a guest in our studio today that has
friend
that has been at the forefront of the urban and community greening movement for decades, long before roofs were being greened in Manhattan and lettuces were being grown on Brooklyn rooftop farms. Gerard Liddell was there.
Yes.
So, Alice, tell us about Gerard.
So, Gerard, thank you for joining us.
Yes.
What a nice intro. Thank you.
So, a little bit about him. Gerard Liddell is the director of GrowNYC.org. He received his degrees from the State University of New York at Farmingdale and at Cornell University in ornamental educational programs that relate to vegetable, fruit, and ornamental gardening. He's partnered with architects, designers, and urban planners. Gerard currently leads a team of dedicated and talented green infrastructure professionals who design, maintain, and coordinate New York City community gardens. These public open spaces often include site amenities such as rainwater collection, solar panels, composting toilets, raised beds, and shade structures such as gazebos and pergolas. The edible gardens provide much-needed food for hungry New Yorkers, as well as providing program services for additional community school and rooftop garden projects each year. And Gerard and I worked on, he was very helpful to me at my old job when Carmen and I were at the Hort. Mm-hmm. I was designing and installing gardens at the Carnegie Branch Libraries. Didn't have a clue how politics and community gardens worked, and you were my go-to guy. I remember calling Gerard like multiple times and him saying, just relax, it'll happen, it'll get done, here's who you call. So, like, an amazing resource.
Thank you. I remember those library gardens. They're amazing, and they're still doing well.
They are, yeah.
Remember the Saratoga branch?
Yeah, that was our first one. Yeah. And now here we are in Bushwick.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny. Carmen and I were here early, and we were walking around just getting a cup of coffee and looking around. And it's so different from what it was
when
you
were making gardens.
Yeah, yeah.
So
when Biggie Smalls died, and I was like digging and listening to Biggie, can't you see? Like, it was very, very, very different.
And we're older, and I had hair back then.
Yeah.
Sad.
And I have gray hair now.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So anyway,
so Gerard, I'd love to ask you about how we asked this a lot of our guests. How did you come to horticulture as a profession? Alice and I are very interested in introducing and encouraging young people to enter the profession of horticulture. That's one of our missions.
Yeah.
Right.
So we like our guests to share the story about what brought you to horticulture and then what brought you to New York City and how you made it work for you.
Right. My grandparents were both, on both sides, immigrants, and on the Italian side, my maternal side, they were farmers in southern Italy. So as a young child, I saw photographs and I heard stories about my grandparents farming the land, and that was intriguing to me. I was born in Brooklyn, Sheepshead Bay. We had multiple generations living in the same house. So I had my grandparents, my aunts and uncles, and I had five siblings with my parents living all together.
Wow.
So we heard all these stories and it fascinated me. And I was the middle child, so I had all these issues, of course, as the middle child. I wanted to be recognized.
Yeah.
So my grandfather on my maternal side would spend a lot of time in the garden growing tomatoes. My grandmother would grow beautiful arugula that I had never experienced before she planted it. And it was a perennial arugula. It came back every year. It was a very spicy arugula. So the garden was a focal point, and as an Italian maternal side of my family, it was all about food. We would wake up, you would talk about what you were going to eat that day, who was going to go shopping. We would go down to Sheepshead Bay to the fishmongers and buy the fresh fish that came in at Sheepshead Bay off of the boats.
Right.
We would grow our vegetables and we would make meals, and it was all about food.
Mm-hmm.
I would spend summers in Sheepshead Bay with my grandparents and help them garden and things like that.
That's great.
On my paternal side, Norwegian immigrants. My grandfather was a sailor, a Norwegian sailor. He sailed the world at 18, and he was also a carpenter. So the carpentry came into play for me as a gardener here in the city, not so much the sailing.
Right.
But I had very strong influences from my immigrant grandparents on both sides to make something of yourself, to do something that made a difference in the world.
Mm.
My dad and my mom were both great people. They're both passed now. But my dad worked in a nursery garden center.
Wow.
And to spend time with my dad, we moved to Long Island with six kids. We had a bigger yard.
Uh-huh.
We all worked at Van's Nursery in Elmont, which was the rite of passage as a teenager in the Lordahl family.
Yeah.
You would have to work every holiday in the greenhouse, in the florist, doing landscaping. And it was a great experience. My siblings and I, most of them worked there as well. So I decided that I liked doing that. It was outdoors. It gave me time with my parents and my siblings working there. And then I was a little insecure, I'll admit it, as a middle child. I was afraid of college.
Yeah.
So I worked during high school in this garden center, and then I, being nervous about college, I wanted to do something I was confident in. Mm-hmm. So I had all this plant knowledge. So mm-hmm. I went to Farmingdale State University.
Which is a great program.
It was a great program, and I worked greenhouses and did landscaping, and we went on a trip to Cornell afterwards, and I decided that I wanted to continue my education in horticulture at Cornell. And then I came out of Cornell in 1980 and worked at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. Mm-hmm. Charlie Mazza, you remember, was my first boss, and I had my dorm room lined with rejection letters. The only one who would take me was the Brooklyn Botanic Garden in 1980, and I worked for $11 an hour at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden Children's Garden. And it was a great experience. And for your young listeners out there, don't be discouraged if you have a low-paying first-time job or an internship, because it opens up doors for you.
Absolutely.
Charlie and that $11 an hour job at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden carried influences with me through my whole career. Because then Charlie went on to Cooperative Extension, and I worked for him at Cooperative Extension as a Manhattan garden agent for 3 years.
Right.
And then Kevin Shank was with me at Cornell. He was a year above me. And Kevin Shank was a predecessor of mine at Council on the Environment, which is now Grow NYC. Mm-hmm. And he encouraged me to come with him to Council on the Environment in 1986.
Okay.
So, you know, those relationships were very important. Even though it didn't come with a high-paying salary, it shaped my career. And I call it a career, not a job.
Right. Well, and it's very interesting that now you're Grow NYC is on the political end of things. Like, who knew? I mean, in the good sense that we're changing place, right? So who knew that, like, your greenhouse and arugula background, you know, was going to turn into this, like, amazing city changing? I remember what the city was like in the 80s. And there were community gardens were just, they were small, little independent neighborhood kind of associations.
More informal,
Well, let me just say, I don't take credit for any of this. I've been in
You
know, I have an executive director. I have an amazing dedicated board. When I first came on to Council on the Environment in 1986, there were visionary people. Mm-hmm. People like, you may know, Bob Lewis and Barry Benepe, who thought about the green markets. Mm-hmm. People like Marion High School and Richard Abrons and Lise McLaughlin. These were people who I had the privilege of working with in 1986 at the Council on the Environment. And they had done a lot of the preliminary work from 1970, because as we know, that's when everything started with Earth Day, May 1970, when a lot of the new community garden movement stuff started to kick in.
Right.
Well, let's talk about a specific garden that was probably one of the most well-known, if not the well-known, community garden. It's called the Liz Christie Garden.
On the Lower East Side,
I don't even know if it's called the Lower East Side now. It's on Houston. What is it called now? I know.
It's Houston.
It's the Liz Christie Garden.
It still is the Liz Christie.
Houston and Bowery.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
There's probably some acronym now for, like, the Lower East Side.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know.
LES.
Yeah, LES.
So tell our listeners who might not have been born then or who were too young to know.
Tell us about Liz Christie.
Who she was and why this garden is named after her, Gerard.
Well, Liz, you know, she lived on Mott Street in the Lower East Side. And you have to go back a little and paint the picture of what New York City was like on the Lower East Side. And I'll go back a little further and say, you know, we had the Depression and the WPA, which was a work program where people were working in parks and trying to fix up the city. Then we had World War II at Victory Gardens. And we had the 1960s with Robert Moses as Parks Commissioner, who had a very top-down way of managing parks and open space. Well, along came this guy, Thomas Hoving, and he wanted to be more inclusive, and he encouraged vest pocket parks. So in the 60s, you heard about these parks associations showing up. Kids were playing on the streets in New York City. They needed safer places to play. And this parks commissioner, I think, shifted the idea of playing in the street, in a sense, in the new modern movement of community gardens into community garden space. Picture 1970, there's a fiscal crisis, there's a lot of abandoned buildings, there's arson. The city is scarred. Buildings are crumbling. It's really
disarray.
A mess. Suffering.
Yeah.
Lots of suffering going on, and all these vacant lots, and people couldn't afford to keep up their buildings, so a lot of the buildings went into foreclosure and then went into the public inventory. So
the city
was burdened with all of these vacant lots that were formerly privately owned, but now were publicly owned. So they couldn't manage them. The best they could do were fence the lots. Mm-hmm. So Liz was sitting in the middle of all this chaos on the Lower East Side with lots of other New Yorkers who couldn't leave. She was an artist. She lived on Mott Street. Mm-hmm. And she saw, like many other visionaries on the Lower East Side, kids playing in these derelict vacant lots. And it upset her, and she wanted to do something about it. Mm-hmm. So her and her comrades, I guess they hearkened back to the Spanish when the French were invading Spain, and guerrillos, they called them. And it was a word that it comes from the Spanish, and it has to do with fighting the overlord. Mm-hmm. And the word guerrilla comes from guerrillos, which is a Spanish word. So
the green guerrillas.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what you're referencing.
Yeah.
Exactly. So when Bonaparte invaded Spain in 1808, she probably came up with this idea of using that word. Mm-hmm. And she coined it, and Liz was the founder of the Green Guerrillas in 1973. Mm-hmm. And with her comrades, they would go around lobbing seed grenades over these city-fenced vacant lots that were filled with, it was either a Christmas ornament filled with fertilizer and seeds and soil, or a balloon. Uh-huh. And they would lob them over the fence because the fences were locked, and they would try to sprout some greenery.
Right.
Liz focused on this big, large garden on Bowery Houston, and they sifted the soil by hand.
Right.
Which is really hard to do if you've never
and
experienced
dangerous.
That. And dangerous.
So dangerous.
And I came onto the scene in the 80s, and I remember that corner. There was the Bowery Mission not far away.
Yes.
You would have a lot of derelict people panhandling on that corner. They would often set fires at night in the trash cans that I would see, and the garden would actually get burned. Tessa Huxley is another name you'll remember.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
She followed in Liz Christie's footsteps and went on to Battery Park City. But Liz was an amazing visionary. She had this artistic sense, and I was happy to she was my predecessor at Open Space Greening. She also started, a lot of people don't know this, the Street Tree Consortium.
Mm-hmm.
And I inherited a lot of her original files. That went on to become Trees New York, which is now a very formidable organization that helps citizens with street tree care, treesnewyork.org. So Liz founded our greening program in 1975. She met with a philanthropist named Richard Abrons in 1975 after she had founded the Green Guerrillas. And Richard Abrons had been traveling up the Metro North rail from his job in Manhattan.
Up to Westchester.
And he saw all these, I was thinking, he was going to Harrison,
right,
in Westchester. Mm-hmm. And he saw all these vacant lots, and he wanted to do something about it. So he asked his friend, his college roommate, Roger Strong, if he knew any connections. And Roger connected Richard with Liz Christie. Liz then worked with Richard to create Plant-A-Lot, mm-hmm. which was a program where Liz developed 17 community gardens citywide with Richard Abrons using private funding. Hmm. And that was through the Council on the Environment.
So what was Richard Abrons' money from? What was he?
His family was in real estate,
okay.
The Lewis and Ann Abrons Foundation. They had a family foundation. Mm-hmm. So Liz and Richard had a great relationship. And Richard is 90 this year. It's amazing. And to date, Richard has helped us build 94 community garden sites around the city.
Right.
And we just dedicated in the Lower East Side, actually, the Richard Abrons Community Garden on Avenue D at 6th Street in the Lower East Side.
Right.
So it was very cool. All these visionary people, Liz was in the forefront of these visionaries who wanted to clean up these vacant lots, and she did it really well. But she did other things as well, like starting the Plant-A-Lot program and Street Tree Consortium.
So I remember 1999 in the Puck Building. It was the Green Gorillas and the Council on the Environment's fundraising, joint fundraising event. And Bette Midler and Trust Republic Land came in at the very last minute and bought a lot of the lots, these community gardens that were up for auction. Carmen lived on the Lower East Side and was involved with a garden.
Ninth Street and Avenue C.
Yeah, and we were just talking about some of the events. Carmen, do you want to talk about the Rite of Spring?
Oh, event? The Rite of Spring was great. So that was in the early 90s. And it was a parade. And
Earth Celebrations.
Earth Celebrations, yes.
With Felicia Young.
Yeah, we would paint our faces, and it was a way to raise awareness and raise funds for the community gardens. So it wasn't quite as a grassroots movement then as it was in the 70s.
Right.
And
it had evolved.
It had evolved. And let's talk
about stewardship, advocacy.
So let's talk a little bit about that evolution. So it starts with Liz Christie. How does it evolve into more of working with the Parks Department and the Federal Housing and Urban Development Program? Because it has to make that leap to get to the level that Alice is talking about.
There's a lot of information in between there, but I'll try and keep it as compact as possible. Okay. I mean, Liz, you know, and the interest in community gardening and fixing up the city really flourished between like 1978 and 1989. There was a great expansion of all these community gardens. And from there, the federal government came in, and in 1978, they provided federal dollars to all of these groups like Liz Christie, who were fixing up community gardens all over the city. And that started the Green Thumb Program, which was under the Department of General Services in the municipality of New York. So here you had a city-funded program that legitimized the community gardeners. So the city saw there was value. They realized there's wisdom in these volunteers maintaining city property, and the Green Thumb Program began. From there, you had preservation categories. The gardens got more and more successful, and the volunteers demanded preservation and security. So like in 1984, there were all these preservation programs that started coming to be, and gardens were put in certain categories. Some gardens were lucky enough, if they were beautiful enough, like yours on 9th and C, Carmen, to get like a 10-year lease or a 5-year lease. And things were looking pretty good through the 80s. In fact, a garden in Crown Heights, the 1100 block Bergen Street Garden, actually became one of the first land trusts through the Trust for Public Land in the 80s. And that was amazing that these homeowners now own that garden and they were able to manage it. So that was really quite a win. And then, as you said, you know, Earth Celebrations in 1991 or so with Felicia Young were doing all sorts of public events. And the gardens were then moved under the Parks Department in 1995, so speed up to 1995. And then the city was looking at these spaces as valuable for development and commercial opportunities. And this is where the problem started. Alice, when you were talking about the Puck Building, what had happened was in 1999, the city administration under the Giuliani administration was looking to sell off these properties. And we were, the Trust for Public Land and the New York Restoration Project under Bette Midler were spearheading this effort to raise funding. And it ended up coming to a settlement with the Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, moderating it with the Green Gorillas. There was a lawsuit. And it wasn't the best scenario, but the Trust for Public Land ended up putting up $2 million and Bette Midler another $2 million to buy 116 community gardens that became owned under those two organizations. They then went on to steward them for the local groups and communities, which then became the land trust sites that we see today. So it was an interesting progression, but that's what brought us to 1999 and this protest. Now, a lot of people thank Giuliani and the community garden movement because he brought the issue to the forefront. My brother in Virginia called me and said, I heard about the garden protests in New York. You know, the London Times was running it. The LA Times was running a news broadcast about New York City gardeners protesting the Giuliani administration because they're selling off 112 gardens. So it gave the community garden movement in New York City quite a bit of national and international exposure.
Right.
So we were being looked at under the magnifying glass. The settlement was resolved. There were 400 gardens put under the Parks Department, and 112 were purchased by the Trust for Public Land and, you know, the New York Restoration Project. And to this day, they're still existing. This is what gives us about 500 to 600 community gardens in general under Parks Land or owned as a land trust.
Right. And we, Carmen and I did a show many, many years ago with New York Restoration and Amy Gavaris, if our listeners want to go back and hear that end
that perspective
of the...
And people have to understand, you know, how valuable land is in New York City, that that accomplishment, like at the tail end of the 90s, when people started, like, waking up and saying, this is, you know...
Well, that's exactly the point, because think, like, Giuliani administration is looking at this saying, look, the city needs money.
Yeah.
You know, developers are swarming around. And when real estate is, I mean, now, you know, $1,000, $1,500, $2,000
a square foot.
Yeah.
And you think about the potential of these empty lots versus greening them.
Sure.
Like, from an economic standpoint, this is, talk about climate change, right?
Yeah.
And, like, what small things we can do as people, you know, to save our cities and create a balance of life.
And to put it in perspective, I mean, New York in the 90s, I'll never forget the moment. A New York City tank, New York City Police Department actually owned a tank.
Yeah.
And I remember it rolling down my street.
Right.
To evict people.
Well, we actually did some work for that developer. We ended up doing work for that developer.
Later on,
in Williamsburg.
Yeah, you were in the belly of the beast, Carmen, down there. And there were really some serious protesters who were up in trees and wouldn't come down. I have images of that.
Yeah.
We had groups of people, and because I was partially in a city agency, we couldn't be involved.
Right, in the protest.
So we would see a lot of the protesters going to City Hall, bringing baskets of vegetables and fruits and busloads of children. My personal first experience was in 1984 up in the Upper West Side at the Dome Garden.
Right.
I was working maybe 4 years out of college, and I saw that despite busloads of children and people and neighbors, elected officials, the borough president, protesting the destruction of the West Side community or the Dome Garden on the Upper West Side, that garden was bulldozed for a $4 million federal housing project. It's affordable housing. Mm-hmm. It's there now. They moved the garden across the street to Brandeis High School, and there is a garden there now. So, you know, open space and housing has always been an issue. And in the 15 cities nationwide, it's always been an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But our thing was always, there can be a compromise. You can have both.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to have one or the other.
Right.
So we would do open space. We had a program called the Housing and Open Space Initiative where we identified housing with nonprofit housing groups, and we built gardens adjacent to them, and there were 12 of those sites.
Right. And now it's, if the higher up you want to go, the more open land you have to allow the community, which has really elicited change. You know,
To get air rights, you have
regulation.
To exchange public space as well. But we have to take a break, Gerard. We'll come right back. Stay tuned to We Dig Plants.
And this one is called Greenwood Cemetery by Teeth People. We'll be right back.
I wanna work no more. Another kicking on the door.
Thanksgiving is a great time to support New York farmers, including local wineries. Find great white wines, red wines, and rosés from Long Island, the Hudson River region, the Finger Lakes, and beyond at New York City wine shops and restaurants. This Thanksgiving, New York Wines is proud to partner with Fleischer's Craft Butchery, which supports local farmers raising heritage breed turkeys in New York State. With a healthy dose of ingenuity and a collaborative winemaking culture, the number of wineries in New York has grown exponentially over the last 10 years, as has the quality of the wines they produce. New York is a world-class wine region offering quality, variety, and value, the perfect trifecta for a bountiful Thanksgiving feast. For information on more than 400 New York wineries, please visit newyorkwines.org.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Alice and I here are with Gerard Liddell, who's with Grow NYC, and we just Gerard just gave us an education on the community gardening movement in New York City.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3.
1, 2, 3, 20 minutes of history. So Grow NYC does so many other things. We could talk to Gerard for hours, but we wanted to get into one of their longest running programs, and I think one of the most successful and that I personally love, their green markets. Okay, it's kind of something that New Yorkers take for granted now. But it wasn't always there. Gerard, will you tell us a little bit about this radical idea and how it came to be?
Sure. Farmers became celebrities.
Yeah. And I would just encourage your listeners to go to our website. I'm the director of the greening program, so my focus is community gardens, and Michael Hurwitz is our green market director, and Marcel Van Ooyen is our executive director. So I don't want to pretend that I know everything about the green markets, but I know more than the average New Yorker because I work at Grow NYC, and I know that in 1976, it was the brainchild of Bob Lewis and Barry Benepe to set up a market trying to promote regional agriculture with farmers that they had known in the local region, and to try to get New Yorkers more access to the freshest, most nutritious, locally grown food. So the first market opened with, as I understand, 5 farmers, and it was underneath the Queensboro Bridge.
Really?
Yeah. And wow. what I understand was people who lived in the area thought there was some kind of a food shortage.
Yeah.
Because they saw all these people online,
yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
Buying the produce.
Right.
That has since progressed into over 50 markets.
Uh-huh.
And thanks to people like Marion Highschool and Lisa McLaughlin, who worked with Barry and Bob Lewis to set up these markets, it continued for quite a long time.
Right.
And now we have a Green Market Co., which is a wholesale arm of the green markets that provides produce to commercial bodegas, mm-hmm. schools, senior centers, things like that.
Is that housed like in the Bronx or in some central location?
In the Bronx.
Okay.
And under Executive Director Marcel Van Ooyen, we're actually going to be building. You may have heard about the governor allocating millions of dollars for a hub,
right?
Which is going to be up in the wholesale district in the Bronx,
and at Hunts Point.
At Hunts Point, and that will fill the gap. In other words, most of the food that we eat, mm-hmm. It doesn't come directly from the producers. But this hub in the Bronx will enable more wholesale produce to come to us and to give New Yorkers more access, and it could be distributed in a much larger way mm-hmm. through the hub that we'll be building. So there are lots of different initiatives. There's the youth market. In addition to Green Market, there's the Fresh Food Box.
Mm-hmm.
The youth market are farm stands that are run by teenagers, and the Fresh Food Box are, it's like a CSA, but you could opt in and out every week. You don't have to make a financial commitment. You order a week in advance. So Green Market has progressed to the point that we're trying to provide as many opportunities for New Yorkers to have more access to better, healthy, locally grown food, and it of course helps the regional farmers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is a time before there was Whole Foods, you know, there were health food stores and stuff, so people really did have, it was, I mean, I grew up like Richard, with I'm an Italian immigrant. Uh-huh. I came from Italy. My parents grew a lot of vegetables. Everything was homemade. We made wine. We canned tomatoes. We still do all that. Right. So I didn't really feel that as a city dweller. To me, it was normal to go pick out everything out of your garden. But New York in the 70s, for other people who lived in apartments, who didn't have open space, this was like incredible opportunity.
Yep.
What I remember, my grandparents are from Western Tennessee, sharecroppers. They moved to outside of Detroit, into Lansing. They worked on the car line. But I remember their community garden because they lived in this tiny little post-World War II house. They had a garden behind their house. But, you know, I remember going with them. And so for me, it was comfortable to see and to learn when I moved to New York that, like, oh, produce is brought into the city. And, you know, there are these community gardens where this food is being produced. So for me, it was kind of normal. But I was also thinking, why isn't there more of this mm-hmm. as a newcomer to New York? Why isn't, and that's why it's been amazing to watch what you all have done, you know, grow into this.
I mean, Union Square Market is like purveyor to chefs. Yeah. Not just
every, it's the fanciest.
It's true. That's, and again, I don't take credit for this. There are incredible visionaries, like, as I said, Bob Lewis and Barry Bennett, and now all of the amazing people, the market managers and the people at Grow NYC and our board, who had this vision and stuck to it. I mean, back in the 80s and 90s, I remember there were people I was working with who knew that there were problems with pressure-treated wood, who were talking about compost way before anyone else was talking about compost. Mm-hmm. We had designed compost signs in the 80s, and you really had to convince people to compost.
Well, New Yorkers are so removed from it, and they always have been as city dwellers, except they haven't because, like you, it extends to their family, and most
somebody
of us
has a memory
from farming,
some connection, you know.
So there was a lot of stick-to-itiveness on the part of people working in many of the greening organizations that brought us from the 70s to 2016 today, where we're still composting and community gardening.
And it also helped that Martha Stewart brought chickens into the armory for one of the art shows. You know,
absolutely,
she saw that necessity in the 80s, and you know, and she married marketing and PR, you know, with what was naturally going on.
So homekeeping. She made it kind of sexy. And now she's cooking with Snoop Dogg. So that's going to be interesting.
That's amazing. Yeah, community gardeners are canning and they're raising chickens and selling eggs and they're producing honey from the community
gardens.
That's
right,
And it's really amazing.
Yeah.
So we've come a long way.
We sure have.
So let's talk about one of the latest initiatives, the Project Farmhouse. That's so interesting, Gerard. It's about to open.
Right, December.
So tell us what that is and where it's going to be and how people can participate.
Sure. We are opening a sustainability education center for New Yorkers, and it's just south of Union Square. It's in the Hyatt Hotel, the ground floor of the Hyatt Hotel.
Oh.
It's 4th Avenue and 13th Street.
Oh.
And it's going to be a place where nonprofit greening groups can come and they could have meetings and they could learn about all the programs that Grow NYC has. We'll have farmers coming in and doing cooking demonstrations. It's an amazing space. It's all state of the art. It's a totally convection kitchen. And there's a hydroponic vertical wall that, you know, is going to be amazing. There's a rental space for businesses that would like to use the space. There's going to be a small retail space where our green market produce and value-added items will be sold. And it'll be a place where kids could come and learn about cooking, where their food comes from. There'll be cooking workshops and nutrition workshops. There'll be recycling workshops. I know you mentioned textiles, and people could learn about where they could bring their textiles or their food scraps. We're collecting amazing amounts of food scraps at the green markets.
Yeah.
That's been being processed into compost at our 10 locations around the city and used again, like on Governor's Island. So it's full circle. And you can learn about all that at Project Farmhouse, opening in December. And it's going to be a great space for people to visit and learn about all things natural and organic and food-wise.
And there's nothing like that in Manhattan, because there's a Botanic Garden in Brooklyn.
Right.
And then there's the New York Botanic in the Bronx, which mm-hmm. has some programs like that. But nothing that I know of in New York that's a real, like, central location.
Hub. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
It's going to be a really amazing space, and it's going to be open for all New Yorkers, and it's going to give you a window into all these things that we're talking about and how you can improve your green life and leave a, you know, smaller footprint.
I think Liz Christie would be pretty proud.
I think so, too.
I think so. And yeah. so close to the Lower East Side.
Yeah. yeah.
I would love that. It came that far.
Yeah. And with Hilton, like, what a great partnership.
Yeah. The space is amazing.
Uh-huh.
And they have, the architects have worked on bringing sunlight from the roof garden down into the meeting space. And as I said, the hydroponic vertical wall is
really
cool.
I can't wait to see it.
All the materials are environmentally sourced. Mm-hmm. It's a totally convection.
Is there going to be like an opening night or something?
There will be, yes. You'll get an invitation. Yes. You're all going to go and buy it.
I want to be there.
It's going to be great.
Yeah.
So, Gerard, let's talk about, so you talked, you touched on the latest things. I want to talk about, even though you're New York City based, you reach out nationally and internationally
mm-hmm.
With materials and programs that can kind of be replicated in other places. Tell us about some of the tools that you've created to help
sure.
other
There
other
are lots
groups.
Of things on our website now. I'd encourage your listeners to go to grownyc.org.
Mm-hmm.
And for one thing, in the greening program, after Superstorm Sandy, many gardens were devastated, and a lot of our fundraising activities were focused on raising money to help the gardens that were devastated by Sandy and the Lower East Side and
right.
the coastal areas of the Bronx and Queens.
Coney Island.
Yeah. So we have a resiliency pamphlet that you can download on the website, and it's not only, it's just great information for gardens and homeowners in general about how you can secure your outdoor space and things you can think about to prevent more devastation, you know, making sure that you've checked out all your trees and shrubs so that if there are broken or damaged branches, you know, the winter doesn't make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
How to protect your shrubs, in case of flooding, how to build raised beds. This was very important. When the surge water came into Coney Island,
mm-hmm.
a lot of gardens, as you guys know, were mm-hmm. just lost. They mm-hmm. lost their soil. They lost their beds. Using lumber is not the way to go in situations like that because it absorbs all of the toxins from the surge water
uh-huh.
and it floats away.
Right. Right.
If you use recycled plastic lumber, which we encourage, it doesn't float, it's heavier, and it doesn't absorb all the toxins. So that's
right.
one example. There's also a storm checklist for gardeners.
Mm-hmm.
The other replicable piece of information is our green infrastructure brochure. And as you guys know, the Horticultural Society, the Green Gorillas, Green Thumb, many of the greening groups, New York Restoration Project, we're capturing rainwater
mm-hmm.
because of the fact that it diverts the water to the sewers, because we have combined sewer overflow in this city, which is a real problem.
Right.
When you have heavy storms,
right.
the sewers back up. And if we could divert the water that goes into the sewers, then that's better for our waterways.
Right, right.
So we have over 100 community gardens that have developed and designed with our green infrastructure staff and with other nonprofits these rainwater collection systems. And this is a manual on how to build them,
uh-huh.
how to do simple things like 50-gallon rain barrels or 1,000-gallon rainwater capturing tanks.
Right.
And if your listeners want to travel to Governor's Island on the weekends, we have a farm out there that illustrates a lot of these green infrastructure.
I've been
pieces.
Out there. It's
oh,
so...
you've seen it?
Oh, yeah. Right. And the chickens.
The chickens,
I love
that's
chicken.
Earth Matters.
Oh, my
composting
God.
Composting project.
It's
yep.
such a beautiful garden.
And you know, beyond just diverting the water, which is important because I live out near Coney Island and I've experienced the backup of our systems.
It's not pleasant.
It's not pleasant.
Yeah, I've never seen Carmen panics when it's going to rain. Like, because well, her now, water table is
I know.
So
well, now
low.
I put in a sump pump, so I'm okay.
Yeah.
But, and I've done some rainwater redistribution too off of my roofs. I'm learning. But if we had a dry year like we have had this year and you have a community garden where there isn't a hose hookup, maybe you can connect to the hydrant, which I don't know if that's allowed still, Gerard, or not. These rainwater systems will allow you to continue to get through that.
Right.
You know, so.
We're in a moderate drought, and we have been, but in severe droughts like we've had, I think in 92 and then back again in like 1985, you're restricted. Community gardens are restricted from using hydrants in a severe drought for understandable reasons. Yeah. The priority is for fires and things like that. The Brooklyn Botanic Garden and the New York Botanic Garden, they have great information that we've sourced, and as partners, we've provided through the Water Resources Group information on how people can design rain gardens.
Yeah.
And rain gardens are great for homeowners, for community gardens, because they're plants. You dig a big well, in a sense. You put gravel down, like 8 feet down, and then you divert as much of the rainwater from the pavement, from your drains as possible into this rain garden. You plant it with plants that can be drought tolerant and flood tolerant.
Yeah.
And we have one at Governor's Island, and we educate people about how to plant a rain garden, and you could see rainwater systems there as well.
Now, if only we could get some subsidies to make this happen. That's the next level.
Well, there
right?
is. They're doing some work in Park Slope and in Gowanus after Sandy. They have these cutout gardens, and I've seen it near Cooper Square.
That's the sponge park.
No, no.
We've been working with the Gowanus Conservancy on workshops and designing systems, and the DEP is doing quite a bit distributing barrels to people.
And street tree stuff. I'm seeing street trees.
So big. So nice. Yeah. And the paving.
Right. Porous pavement.
Right.
Right.
We just actually did that at the Old Stone House. There's a cul-de-sac next to the house that we had repaved with that, and it
absorbs
porous paving. And it's so amazing.
Yeah, it really does work well.
Yeah.
The Phoenix Garden on Fulton Street in Brooklyn, they also have porous paving that we worked on with them, and a nice setup with a nice shade structure. So you could work in a lot of different elements in the garden and have a nice green footprint.
Right.
Like so how hard is it, Gerard, to get? I remember there used to be a lot of politics involved with getting a community garden plot. It was sometimes challenging in some places.
Tenacious.
Is it still tough to
get a key?
I call it key to the city, right?
Yes,
that's right.
It is.
That's right.
You know, it depends on who owns the land. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we have been developing new open spaces.
Yes.
And we've added a substantial amount of open space in the last 3 years with 21 gardens and like 75,000 square foot of new open space for New Yorkers.
We need
through
it.
Community gardens. And how does that happen?
Right.
Well, we have a great partnership with the Department of Parks and Recreation, and we work with them and Green Thumb. And we identify sites that need refurbishing or that need to be developed that are not necessarily developable for housing because they are thrown off the list because of other reasons.
There's
like
a stream.
Subways underneath or streams.
As
you know, in the Lower East Side with all those underground tributaries, you can't really build.
Right, but so, infrastructure, like subways and
that's
big, huge main water pipes and, you know, that can't be.
One of the gardeners in the Liz Christie Garden, going back to her, when they were first digging, Dan Loggins, he wrote that when he was digging at that garden, he hit light as he was digging at Barry and Houston, and it ended up being
it was China.
It was the light from the subway platform underneath that he was seeing, and you know that the line runs right there. So anyway, that is a real issue, and there are sites in the outer boroughs that we've developed because they were on top of MTA train platforms or stations. So things like that, not to the if the land is not developable. But the average citizen cannot really access those lots. It goes through city agencies. You can identify as a New York City resident. If there's a vacant lot in your neighborhood that's privately owned, you could write a letter, which I've done on several occasions, to people in your neighborhood. Find out by going to the website and the city for real estate who the owner is.
Uh-huh.
Say, hey, are you interested in that vacant lot maybe being a community resource for a couple of years, and we could build a community garden on your private property? What do you think? Some private owners going through the right legal procedures with liability are willing to do that, or organizations like the Salvation Army. They provided a local school with their land to build a garden during the interim of while they were building their larger building. So there are opportunities.
Okay.
You know, so city land, there's organizations. I would suggest if it's a city-owned property, you contact Green Thumb at the Parks Department, and they have general numbers on their website, and you find out if it's city-owned and if it's available. If it, there are other organizations like 596 Acres, your listeners can Google 596 Acres.
Mm-hmm.
That came as a result of the founder looking at a Brooklyn city planning map and finding that there were like 596 acres of possible vacant land that could be developed in Brooklyn alone. And Paula Siegel is a trained lawyer, and she works with community groups to obtain these pieces of property. Not always successful, but 596 Acres is doing some amazing things in developing new space as well. And you'll see their sign up on a property that says, "We're looking for people to volunteer." So
right.
You could do that. You could also check out oasis.net.
Mm-hmm.
And on our website, you could connect to community gardens that are in your neighborhood. You may not know there's a garden in your neighborhood that you could volunteer in.
Right, and get some dirt under your fingers.
Yeah. We have a searchable website on grownyc.org.
So people can still volunteer.
Oasis.net.
There's still opportunities for people to volunteer at existing gardens.
Yes.
It may be easier to go that way. You're not going to start from scratch.
Yeah.
When I first started this job, there were 25,000 vacant lots in the 80s that were city-owned. 25,000 vacant lots. And now there are a handful.
Yeah,
the city has divested themselves of owning vacant lots for good reason. We're in a housing crisis.
Yeah.
Well, we have to end the show. I'm sorry, Gerard.
This is so fun.
We have to have you back for 2.0.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been fun.
Thank you
so
for all the work you've done.
And all the work that
you've
done.
To make New York amazing.
On behalf of all of my coworkers, I thank you.
Yeah. And now we're going to have pizza.
Great.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. You know where the handles are, I think, at this point.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week with another show on politics in place. Stay tuned to the next show. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.